I've noticed a number of peculiar incidents among the members of the student body, all having to do with rock and roll music.
Wham bam, Benjamin!
Now, if you don't think this song is the greatest song ever, I will fight you.
In 1966, Bob Dylan stunned the music world with his unprecedented double album, Blonde on Blonde. Even more shocking is that now, at age 75, Dylan's career is still going strong, and of course, his influence is immortal.
We conclude our celebration of Bob Dylan's life and music with a close look at Blonde on Blonde with rock legend Al Kooper. Then we explore Dylan's late career renaissance. That's coming up on Sound Opinions.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And today, we're continuing our look back at Bob Dylan as he hits the milestone of his 75th birthday. Last week, we explored a relatively short but fruitful period in his career, the early 60s, that time in New York on the folk scene leading up to the fateful day in Newport, Rhode Island, July 1965, when Dylan electrified his music, the audience was in turn electrified, and neither would ever be the same. We revisited our 2009 conversation with Al Kooper, who was with Dylan during that tour when he plugged in, and he became one of Dylan's longest-running collaborators. In fact, that is Kooper's trademark Hammond organ that you're hearing on Dylan's famous 1965 track, Like a Rolling Stone.
That's the game changer for a lot of people. 6-minute single released during the summer of 65. The historians tell us it changed everything. The length of the song, the sound, the fact that Dylan had gone electric full on. He had this amazing guitar player at his side as well, Mike Bloomfield out of Chicago, playing those riffs and fills behind him, the music swelling up and then receding. Dylan at his most caustic. Kooper, an untrained virtuoso, if you will, on that Hammond. He really didn't know what he was doing, but Dylan loved the sound he was getting, and they became comrades in arms ever after. Now, Dylan went on the road soon after playing his electric music to sort of mixed receptions. People weren't quite sure what to make of it. It was loud. It was in your face. It was unlike anything Dylan or anyone else from the folk movement had attempted before. Clearly, the ground was shifting beneath everyone's feet, and they weren't quite sure what to make of Bob Dylan at this point. But he was determined to plow ahead. He had found something that had really inspired him not only as a musician, but as a songwriter.
Greg, you know, you made the point earlier, it was an extraordinary period of less than a year and a half that gave us, bringing it all back home, Highway 61. But the real capper was Blonde on Blonde, one of rock's first double albums. I think the single best album in Dylan's canon. And I would say one of the best albums of all time, period.
And it just turned 50 years old. Blonde on Blonde came out May 16th, 1966. The very same day, by the way, that the Beach Boys released Pet Sounds, another classic album we talked about a few weeks ago.
We're going to focus on this record. It is an extraordinary anniversary, and I think it's a really great way to examine Dylan's artistry. He began recording Blonde on Blonde with his touring band at the time, that Canadian group known as the Hawks, who would eventually become the band. Dylan starts in New York, but the sessions don't go particularly well.
Now you're my
Bob Johnson, the producer, had encouraged Dylan to give Nashville a shot. So he heads down there with Al Kooper and Robbie Robertson of the Hawks, and they're joined by a bunch of stellar Nashville session cats, harmonica player, guitarist, and bassist Charlie McCoy, guitarist Wayne Moss, guitarist and bassist Joe South, and drummer Kenny Buttrey. All of a sudden, something clicks. So we asked Al Kooper what was different about recording with Dylan in Nashville.
Everything.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time I had gone to another city and played in a recording studio. And I didn't know the session musicians at all, and they didn't know me. And Bob brought Robbie and I to make him feel more comfortable, because he didn't know any of these people.
Mm-hmm.
The musicians were fantastic. They were roughly our age, and they were really nice people. There was no uptightness or any, just everybody was really nice, and it was a very comfortable situation. And I don't think they knew who Bob was. And it didn't matter. Then when I heard them play, it was unbelievable. I'd never heard people play like that before. The New York session musicians were very different, mostly because they were older. On that album, I was music director. And so I would teach the band the songs before Bob got there, and I had arrangement ideas that I would throw out so that Bob would come like an hour later and we would have one or two songs worked out so he didn't have to sit through us learning the songs, which was my idea. And as we started doing that, I just couldn't believe the finesse and the beauty with which these guys played.
Well, early in the morning, late at night, I got a poison headache, but I feel all right. I'm pledging my time.
Well, the session musicians were hip and cool and welcoming. I heard you got run out of a record store on a rail by some Tennesseans who wanted to kick your New York butt. Was that hostile outside the studio for Dylan, too? I wonder if that reflected on things.
Well, Bob didn't go out. You know, Bob was in his hotel and then at the recording studio. Actually, Bob Johnston had gotten one of Elvis's bodyguards, a guy named Lamar Fike, who was fabulous. And my hair wasn't even really long yet.
Al, tell us about those hotel sessions. You and Dylan are in a room. You're on piano. He's writing the songs. How did that go?
Yeah, there were no cassettes invented yet. So Bob asked me to come to his room, and he would teach me the song, the music of the song. Then I would play it on the piano, and he would write lyrics. But, I mean, continuously play it for hours. And that's how I got to know the songs prior to the sessions. And when I was playing it, I had all these arrangement ideas.
The arrangements on that on those songs are fantastic. The versatility of the band, you're talking about people like Charlie McCoy and Joe South, Kenny Buttrey, these great players, Wayne Moss. I think you told a story once, Al, if I'm not mistaken, about Charlie McCoy balancing the bass guitar and some brass, I think, simultaneously, right?
No, that is correct. We were running down You Go Your Way, and Charlie said, I'd like to play that part that you're playing on the organ on the trumpet with you. I said, that'd be great, but Bob doesn't like to overdub, so unless we get another bass player, I don't know how we could. He says, I can play the bass and the trumpet at the same time. And now Bob was in the conversation. And so Bob and I cracked up. He said, no, really. So we started running it down, and the band was playing. And he played with his left hand, you know, the neck of the bass, and thumped down with that. And with his right hand, he played the trumpet at the same time. So he's going like, you know, boom, 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 with his left hand, and with his right, he's going bum ba da ba da ba da bum ba da bum boom. Bob and I were on the floor just laughing. So Charlie said, I can do it. So Bob said, okay, but just be somewhere where I can't see you.
Kisses, and I like his, but this time I'm not gonna tell you why that is. I'm just gonna let you pass. Yes, and I'll go last, and time will tell who has fell and who's been left behind when you go your way and I go mine.
You're
listening to Sound Opinions, and we're talking about Dylan's initial electric flourishing and the 1966 masterpiece double album, Blonde on Blonde. We're here with Al Cooper. Al, there was a lot of levity and a lot of experimentation during these sessions. Dylan has even been described as demanding a Salvation Army band in one of the tunes, which would become one of the album's standouts, Rainy Day Women, numbers 12 and 35. Can you tell us about recording that?
So Kenny Buttrey, the drummer, he played a big bass drum that they had in the back, and I played tambourine. I didn't even play an instrument on that. And I sort of was like the commander of the yelling and screaming. I just read an interview where Bob Johnson says this year that we were marching around the studio and they recorded that. But of course you can't do that. You have to be in one place so you can be mic'd and have headphones on and stuff like that. So we weren't. The only person that could play brass was Charlie McCoy, but he couldn't play two brass at the same time and the bass. So he called up a guy about 1 o'clock in the morning, a trombone player. And at 2 a.m., in comes Wayne, clean shaven with a shirt and tie on. And he unpacks his trombone and Charlie teaches him, you know, bah, 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 bah. And the two of them play, the trombone and the trumpet.
Well, they'll stone you when you're walking on the street. They'll stone you when you're trying to keep your seat. They'll stone you when you're walking on the floor. They'll stone you when you're walking to the door. But I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned.
So we did a few takes, and I would say by 2:40 we had a take, and we thanked Wayne and he packed up his trombone and went home. I thought that was really, the recording of that song was really bizarre.
Well, and the only thing weirder than the final name, Rainy Day Women number 12 and 35, was the original name. Is this true? Was it actually known in the sessions Dylan was going to call it A Long-Haired Mule and A Porcupine Here?
Well, what happened is one day when we had done about 3/4 of the songs and Bob Johnson came in and he says, what are the real titles of these songs? And he started reading the titles off. And Bob just was, you know, in those days, he was Bob. He would just like make up nonsense titles for the songs, but with a straight face. We had some great times. We did laugh a lot. Every day I would talk to Bob on the phone before I went to the studio and say, I'm going to do these songs today. And I always tried to get I Want You in because that was my favorite. And that really was my total arrangement, that song. There was nobody improvised anything except what I'm going to tell you. So Bob wouldn't let me ever do I Want You. Because he knew how much I liked it. So I think that was the last song that we did on the sessions. So we were running it down, and and Wayne Morse goes, like a 16th note phrase.
I want you. I want you. I want you so bad, honey, I want you.
I've never heard anyone in New York play anything like that. So I stopped and I said, and we were just rehearsing, and I said, can you do that again? So he did it again. I said, can you play that every time we come to that part in the song?
Mm-hmm.
He said, sure. And I said to myself, this is unbelievable. This is unbelievable.
I want you.
Bob was obviously having a great old time, but there was an incredible amount of pressure on him to produce great records. You guys probably knew you were under a microscope to a degree because he had exploded with Highway 61 Revisited.
Well, for one thing, there were many days where he would sit at the piano in the studio and work on the lyrics. I don't think any of these songs were really finished before we got to Nashville. Musically, they were, but not lyrically to his satisfaction. So, like, let's say he would get there at noon, and we'd have a couple of songs ready to go. If it was one that he wasn't happy with the lyric, he would sit at the piano and work on the lyric. And we would play ping pong, have lunch, watch television. And sometimes it would be 6 or 7 p.m. before we would start the session, because he'd be just sitting there for 6 hours writing a lyric.
The kings of Tyrus with their convict list are waiting in line for that geranium kiss. It would happen like this, but who among them really wants just to kiss you?
I remember some Nashville press guy came in like at noon and they threw him out, and then he came back about 4 o'clock and he saw Bob was in the exact same position that he was at 12 at the piano. And he came in, he looked, he says, "God, what's that guy on?" And Albert said, "Columbia Records and Tapes." That was one of my favorites.
You're clearly having fun making this album, and you guys were making history at the same time.
Well, I did have had one moment where I was working out a part for myself, and I thought to myself, you know, wherever my fingers go, it's going to be forever. And then I said to myself, lock that up, throw it in some dark corner, and go back to whatever you've been doing, because it seems to work.
Mm-hmm.
Making Highway 61 was very chaotic, and that's why it sounds the way it sounds. Blonde on Blonde was, you know, like a finely crafted lawn or something. The groundspeople paid attention to everything. And we just tried to play as good as we could play. And when I hear, like, Memphis Blues again, Joe South is playing guitar on that, and I'm playing organ, and we're sort of trading licks, and it's a very long track. I can't believe that I was 22 years old. It was just inspiring.
And the ladies treat me kindly, and they furnish me with tea. Inside my heart, I know I can't escape. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again.
That is rock legend Al Kooper talking to us back in 2009 about recording Blonde on Blonde. When we come back on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, it's Bob Dylan's Modern Times. We want to invite you to share your sound opinions on the air. Share your thoughts on Dylan's Electric Period at 888-859-1800.
To find out if she's talked, but the post office has been stolen, and the mailbox is locked. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Mona tried to tell me to stay away from the train line. She said that all the railroad men just drink up your blood like wine. And I said, oh, I didn't know that. But then again, there's only one I've met, and he just smoked my eyelids and punched my cigarette. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside a mobile.
I'm sick of love. I'm sick of
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. Today we're saying happy 75th birthday to Bob Dylan. Last week we focused on Dylan in the early 60s, and we just heard Al Kooper talk about the electric era and Blonde on Blonde. So now we're going to fast forward just a little bit.
We could use 17 episodes on this, Craig.
We could, but we're going to go to the modern times. That song is a live version of Lovesick from the 1999 tour, when Charlie Sexton just joined the band, giving the band a three-guitar lineup with Sexton, Larry Campbell, and Bob Dylan.
Now, I've made the point a couple times in our examination of Dylan that I had to learn to love him. And part of the reason was I started going to see him at 17, 18, or 19, and I don't think I saw a good Dylan show for the first 15 years, four or five attempts to go see one. People kept saying, you're going to love this guy live. There was a period there really heavy in the 80s where he just wasn't on fire and he just didn't seem to care. Then all of a sudden, in the early 90s, something clicked. And there was another 10-year period from the early 90s to early in the new millennium where I saw Dylan easily 15, 16 times, and I didn't see a bad show. He was challenging that band by leading it with the guitar and pushing it in places it clearly had never been and was going somewhere different every night, especially when Sexton and Campbell were both in the band. You remember those tours.
It was awesome.
Extraordinary stuff. And that's why we decided to conclude by bringing the focus up to modern times. There's obviously some incredible work in the 70s that we're glossing over. We left off in 1966 with Blonde on Blonde. Less so, less spectacular in the 80s, but we wanted to underscore that Dylan is that rare artist who has never lived in the past, who has never rested on his laurels. That's why we thought it would be fun to talk about the recent past and into the present. Today, Dylan is suffering from arthritis. This is why he's supposedly playing piano and leaving the guitar on the stand. I don't think, as a result of that he's as strong on stage today as he was in the 90s. But who knows? Next week, he could be back.
Yeah, you never know with Dylan, Jim. He's one of those guys that could give a terrible performance one night, and then the glory days are back the next night. That's why he remains so relevant. In tandem with the live performances, Jim, and you're absolutely right, the guy really rediscovered his muse on the road, just constantly playing his songs in front of anybody who had wanted to hear them. The studio recordings recovered as well. There was a time there where Dylan was questioning whether he ever wanted to write another song or whether he ever wanted to make another album. And it all turned around for him when he hooked up with Daniel Lanois in 1989 to make the Oh Mercy record. That was his finest album in a decade plus. Returned with Lanois in 97 to make Time Out of Mind, which swept the Grammy Awards that year and put Dylan in a new place. Really unprecedented when you think about it. An artist in the late phase of his career, once again at the top of his game. I really can only think of maybe a handful of rock and rollers that have achieved what Dylan did in that decade by making that comeback. And then he followed it up with Love and Theft in 2001 and Modern Times in 2006. Very strong series of albums, especially when you consider it's essentially the third act in Bob Dylan's career.
Now, Oh Mercy and Time Out of Mind were both produced by Daniel Lanois, who was famous for working with U2 among many others. But the engineer on those records was equally important, Mark Howard. He's worked with people, a huge resume, ranging from Avril Lavigne to Iggy Pop. We spoke with Mark in 2009, and here he relays his first experience working with Bob Dylan. He was in New Orleans for Oh Mercy in 88 and 89, and Dylan wasn't even sure he'd keep writing songs.
I think his frame of mind was probably a searching period for him because, like you said, you know, it just came out of that 80s period. And so I think Dan Lanois was searching for, you know, kind of get him back to writing some great songs. Dan would always be pushing him to write another song like Lay 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 or, you know, like one of those big classics. And Dylan was like, well, I don't got that anymore. So the way the sessions started out, it was kind of small. Just Dan and Dylan in the room. He didn't know us, and we didn't know him, so it's trying to find that working balance. I was an assistant, really, on that record, and Malcolm Byrne was the engineer, and because Malcolm was a musician, he ended up playing keyboards and harmonica and a couple other things. So, you know, Dylan would be sitting in a chair, and he would be playing sloppily, and then, you know, I put the microphone in front of his mouth, and he'd move the other way, and so I'd move it over to where he was, and then he'd move the other way. So I literally had to sit on the floor with a mic stand following him around to get some takes out of him. It was kind of crazy there for a while.
It sounds like it could have been really intimidating.
It was. Dan has certain type of temperament for people, and you know he wants everybody to put in everything they got. And I think Dylan was being a little bit, you know, was playing against us a little bit and was testing us really to see how far we would go.
I've read that he would not even look at you or use your name for the first weeks and weeks into the recording process, right?
Yeah, it was a strange thing because I was there and he was just kind of like pretending like I didn't even exist. It's like that with any relationship. I think you have to win the person over. I'm into motorcycles and I had a couple of Harleys outside. And so he said, hey, do you think you could get me one of those bikes? And I thought, yeah, man, I can get you whatever you want. And so he came up with some money and I went to Florida on the weekend and I got him like a 1966 Electra Glide, like a real classic, a real beauty. It was like baby blue and white. And so we hit off on a motorcycle enthusiast world. So it was a lot of talking about bikes. And I get the bike running for him and he'd go out for a ride. And then he'd come back and he'd say, you know, the police are real friendly around here. And I said, they're not friendly. They're waving at you because you're not wearing a helmet. They're trying to pull you over. So it's like, it was quite funny.
It seems like he had to get away sometimes. I would imagine you guys wanted to get away from him. The question about Oh Mercy, at the time, I remember, was a lot of people were curious about how Dylan would relate to this producer, Daniel Lanois, who was known for kind of having a heavy hand when it came to putting a sonic imprint on the records. How did that tension resolve between those two?
Well, Dylan wrote something pretty interesting in that Chronicles book where he said he didn't know what we were going for, and he was taking these long rides in the country, and then it came to him. He finally figured out what angle we were coming from and where we were going, and then until that point, he was kind of like against us, and then once he figured it out, he's like, wow, this is actually sounding really great, and I really like how it sounds, so it's a great sound for him, and we got an amazing vocal sound on him. Wisdom is thrown into jail. It rots in a cell, misguided as hell, leaving no one to pick up the trail. We live in a political world where mercy walks the plank. Life is in mirrors, death disappears up the steps of you, the nearest bay.
So Dylan starts out, Mark, by saying he wants a real 50s sound, right? You know, he's fascinated with the way records were made in the 50s. You know, often one microphone, a lot of presence, a depth of field.
Time Out of Mind was the record where we had a studio in Oxnard, California. I was renting this old 1940s Mexican porn cinema. It was like shut down for years, and I kind of moved in there and took all the seats out and converted into this huge studio. And that's kind of where Time Out of Mind started. And Bob would drive up from his place in Malibu area. And in between Malibu and Oxnard, he would get this radio station in his pickup truck that played like all the great classics from the 50s and then right on up to like Little Walter and all these, you know, great blues records. And he said, like, why do those records sound so great, and why can't anybody get that today? I said, we can get it. We just have to approach it in that method where we used only tube microphones and ribbon microphones and classic preamps. And yeah, I'd only use one or two mics on the drums, and it was pretty ambient sounding. And that was the approach I took on Taiwan of Mine. Well, my nerves are exploding. And my body's tense. I feel like the whole world got me pinned up against the fence. I've been hit too hard. I've seen too much. Nothing can heal me now. But your touch. To tell you the truth, we started there in Oxnard, and we had an amazing sound. It was like some of the best piano sounds I got and a killer vocal sound. And we were ready to make the record there, and Bob said, you know, look, this is too close to home. I can't work here. You know, I got family and stuff here. I need to be, like, isolated and go somewhere where I can think and write these songs. So then one day he comes in, let's go to Miami. It was, like, the furthest point away. So I remember at Christmas time, I loaded the truck at Christmas, and I drove all the way to Miami with all the same microphones and all of the same. I brought these little Neve BCM-10 mixers with me and a bunch of motorcycles, and we ended up going to Criteria in Miami, we were working in this big room in Criteria, but the room was like a film, one of those big film rooms where they shoot video. So the room didn't have a very good sound. It was really kind of, the room itself was spitty and echoey. So I was a bit bummed there for a while. Things turned around. I'd set up this little apartment for Bob because it was such a huge room and there was like 15 people in the room at the same time. So he needed to be isolated at the same time. So I, out of gobos and stuff, I built a little apartment for him with little windows and a lamp. And so he had a little place to hide out. It wasn't until then that it created a vibe in there and it actually felt good and things started to sound better.
Talk about the writing aspect of Dylan as a lyricist. It sounded like initially it was just like a lot of words on a page, and how do we turn these into songs? Was that an initial issue for you and Lanois?
I don't think so, because the way he works is just incredible. I've never seen anybody else really work this way. It's all in his head, and he can pull verses out of his head on, you know, just on the spur of a second. You'd have like songs like Highlands on Time Out of Mind, where the song's 17 minutes long. For 17 minutes, you can remember every verse.
But it must be a holiday. There's nobody around. She studies me closely as I sit down. She got a pretty face and long white shiny legs.
We'll have more on Bob Dylan after a quick break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. And later on, you, the listener, have the last word. Want to share your sound opinions about Bob Dylan or anything in the music world? Call 888-859-1800 and leave us a message.
I say that's right. Bring me some. She says we ain't got any. You picked the wrong time to come. Then she says, I know you're an artist. Draw a picture of me. I said I would if I could, but I don't do sketches from memory. Well, she's me, she says I'm right here in front of you. Haven't you looked? Crickets are chirping, the water is high. There's a soft cotton breeze on the line, hanging dry. The windows wide open, African trees bent over backwards from a hurricane breeze. Not a word of goodbye, not even a note. She gone with a man in a long black coat.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. That is Bob Dylan performing Man in the Long Black Coat. We're going to continue our celebration of the singer and songwriter, now 75 years old. In 2009, we spoke with engineer Mark Howard, who worked on two of Dylan's best efforts from the third act of the master's career, Oh Mercy in 1989, and Time Out of Mind in 1997. Mark told us about how those cricket sounds in the song Man in the Long Black Coat came courtesy of, wait for it, Brian Eno.
We had just finished a record with the Neville Brothers, which was the Yellow Moon record. And Brian Eno had come in on that to help out. And he has a Yamaha DX7, which he's totally gotten into the memory and customized all of the sounds. And so during the Yellow Moon session, these crickets appeared, and he has these insect sounds. And in New Orleans, there's these cicada bugs that make this like really kind of like whistly kind of loud tone. Eno would be communicating with the insects. He would do a melody, and then the insects would copy the melody. And I thought, wow. And then he'd do it again, and they would do it again. So he's actually communicating with his insects with his keyboard sound, which is very strange. So he ended up leaving those cricket sounds with us. So we had those cricket sounds in our DX7. So when it came around on Oh Mercy that Malcolm was playing the crickets. Well, you know, I was recording the song, and so it became part of that track. And, you know, Man in a Long Black Coat, I think, is one of the classic songs of that record. You know, it's haunting.
She never said nothing, that was nothing she wrote. She gone with a man in a long black coat.
Well, it was an odd time for Dylan because he'd fallen off the map in a lot of ways. Oh Mercy was, I think, now widely acknowledged as sort of the first step in his comeback, his late career comeback. And then you returned to the studio with him to make Time Out of Mind in 96. The album was eventually released in 97. At that time, too, Dylan had not recorded any original songs in a period of like 6 or 7 years. He had once again stalled. It sounded like the vibe was similar to where he was with Oh Mercy, in that he was at a period in his career where he was questioning whether or not he even wanted to be in the studio anymore and writing new music. What was your assessment of where Dylan was at when the recording sessions for Time Out of Mind began?
Time Out of Mind started with an invitation from Dylan at that time to mix. He did the show for the House of Blues, I think for the Olympics or something, and they wanted Dan to mix it. And so I mixed it with Dan. And that was really how it started, where I'd finished doing all of the songs that he wanted mixed for this live session. And it was like the very last song. He goes, "This song's got a harmonica in it. Like, can you make it sound electric?" So I said, "Okay, yeah, I can make it sound electric." So I took it off the tape and I ran it through like a little tube screamer kind of guitar distortion pedal and then into like a little Tweed amp, and then I re-recorded it back on a track. So that way he would have this kind of distorted harmonica sound. But after he finished with the harmonica, his vocal came through that amp. And when he heard his vocal come through this distorted amp, he's like, "Wow, that sounds amazing." I had to remix the whole record with that vocal sound on there.
There's a rush, there's a beat.
That became the sound for Time Out of Mind.
You know, a lot of people look back at that record, Mark, and talk about it as Dylan confronting his mortality. You know, he's well into his 50s by now. The story that gets confused for some people is that he did, in fact, suffer a life-threatening illness after that record was recorded, and people sort of conflate those events wrongly. But what was your take? Was Dylan kind of looking at his life? I mean, did you sort of see it in any way as a dark record when Dylan was making it?
No, I didn't have that vibe at all. I thought it was quite uplifting at the, like when we first started, because he was coming out when we were mixing that show for him. He'd say, "I got these new songs. You want to hear them?" And he'd go over to the piano and he'd play this track for Dan, but he wouldn't sing. And he'd say, "Well, what do you think?" And Dan would go, "Well, sounds great, but I need to hear some lyrics." And then the next day he'd come in and goes, "Yeah, I'll play you another song." And he'd go to the piano and play it and goes, "So what do you think of that one?" And Dan goes, "Well, that's really great, but I really need to hear some lyrics." So he came on this other day and he played Can't Wait on piano. And I swear to God, it was so haunting, the hair on my arms went up. It was like a gospel version of Can't Wait. We were like blown away and we thought, wow, if this is any idea of what the record's going to be, it's going to be a classic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because it's gospel, it's uplifting, you know? Like, there's no darkness to it. So that song, Can't Wait, became like a pillar of the beginning of the record.
Will you ever lay awake at night, your face under the wall?
This thing was, we went to Miami and we tried to cut it with a band, and it wasn't happening in Miami, not with the band. It was like, it was a whole other thing. And so we never quite got back to that version. And the version that's on the record is a great one, But I swear to God, that other one is... But it was a shame, because that was the thing that Dan was striving for. And it became an issue on Time Out of Mind where, you know, Dan was really going for it. And, you know, Dan would work up the band, and Dylan would walk in, and he heard that they were working up Can't Wait. And he's like, I'm not recording that song ever again. And then Dylan went into, like, this kind of crazy man zone where he had these, like, golf gloves on, and he would hold the guitar backwards like a baseball bat, and he would slowly kind of pitch it, like if he was like doing a baseball kind of like at Dan's head, like if he was going to hit him with it. it was really straight. And then at that point, Dylan wouldn't talk to Dan directly. You'd always talk through me to talk to Dan. And they had this little while where things got really intense in the studio, where, you know, we'd be listening back to a take and Dan would go, "Wow, it's really great," and Dylan would turn to me and look and go, "You hear somebody talking?"
I'm like, oh man!
In the end, you know, they're good friends, and it's just like it's just wild to kind of go through those kind of moments where he won't talk to him, so they're talking. Dylan's only talking to me, and Dan's only telling me what to tell him, and so it was like I was the middleman there for a while.
It's interesting too that Dylan has never really, every record since then, I believe, has been a self-produced record. He's not really worked with outside producers since then. And the sound is, on the more recent records, is a little bit more, you know, band in the studio being recorded live versus the Time Out of Mind record. It is a singular record in his catalog. Nothing else sounds quite like it.
Shadows are falling, and I've been here all day. It's too hot to sleep, and time is running away. Feel like my soul has turned into steam. I've still got the scars, not the sound in me.
It's funny because for a while, like in the beginning, I thought that record was a little harsh sounding, a little harder, you know, than Oh Mercy is a little more pleasant to listen to, big richer sounds and kind of like wider textures, where on Time Out of Mind, because it's 15 people playing in one room all at the same time, the record had a lot of leakage in the vocal mic, and because of that it makes it a little more harsher in a way. It's not as big and warm round sound like if you did a vocal off a, you know, mm-hmm, by itself in a room. When you hear it years later, it's like, wow, okay, yeah, that really does work.
Why do you still do it? Why are you still out here?
Well, it goes back to the destiny thing. I mean, I made a bargain with it a long time ago, and I'm holding up my end.
What was your bargain?
To get where I am now.
Should I ask who you made the bargain with?
with the chief commander.
On this earth?
In this earth, and then in the world we can't see.
If you're just joining us on Sound Opinions, that's Bob Dylan talking about selling his soul to the devil during a 2004 interview with 60 Minutes. Mark, even at this lofty point in his career, where he's accomplished so much, he likes to bring chaos into the mix. Is he either fooling around and always just trying to get a rise out of people, or does he like to keep everybody off balance just because he thinks creativity comes from that place?
I'm sure it's a little of both, but when I'm alone in the room with Bob, he's just like you and me, and we're just talking just like this. But if somebody walks in the room that he doesn't know, he goes into a character. And I've seen him do this quite a few times where, you know, like Billy Bob Thornton dropped by the studio one day and Dylan went into this like weird character on him and like, "Hey, how are you?" And started talking different. It was just like strange. And, you know, like wouldn't give Billy Bob his hand to shake. He would just give him his finger. You know, he'd just hold out his finger, and like, then Billy Bob would grab his finger and shake him, like, "Okay, how are you?"
Every day your memory goes dimmer. It doesn't haunt me like it did before. I've been walking through the middle of nowhere, trying to get to heaven before they close the door.
That was engineer Mark Howard talking to us in 2009 about working with Bob Dylan on Oh Mercy and Time Out of Mind.
Greg, we want to highlight a couple of specific songs from this late period in Dylan's career.
Really strong period in the studio as far as I'm concerned. A lot of music recorded, a lot of music left on the shelf or reconfigured for later albums. Dylan was extremely prolific during those sessions, especially with Lenoir for the Oh Mercy record in 89 and Time Out of Mind in 1997. Some of his best performances got left on the shelf, Jim. He recorded this song, Mississippi. It ended up on his Love and Theft record in 2001, but I think the versions that he cut out of the Time Out of Mind record in 97 were actually superior to it,
yeah,
which is remarkable. I mean, you think about what he was trying to achieve in the studio. Dylan was wanting a more of a stripped-down record. Lenoir wanted more production. So the stripped-down version of Mississippi got left behind on that record, but I think it's a fascinating Dylan performance. There's a couple of things going on here. One, he's reaching back to more traditional music as a jumping-off point. This he did in his early career. He would look back at the old folk and blues songs that were his inspiration and then try to write a new Dylan song out of that kernel, out of that seed. He took an old prison song called Rosie, took a line or two out of that and used it as a jumping off point for this brand new composition where he looked at his own mortality. The whole idea of this prison gang singing about, man, if I'd only gotten out of Mississippi one day earlier, I might not be here. And he's sort of applying that to his own life in this song. I think it is a rambling folk epic right up there with Tangled Up in Blue in sort of assessing his life as this long journey. And here we are. People have talked about the deterioration of his voice. I think in this song, the vocal performance is extraordinary. The voice is more limited, sure, than it was in the 60s, but there's still a lot of flexibility in it, a lot of pliability, and it comes across. It's a beautiful song where he has a sense of humor. When he's talking about those lines, things should start to get interesting right about now. The way he delivers those lines, just remarkable stuff. This is Bob Dylan with Mississippi on Sound Opinions.
Well, my ship's been split to splinters. It's sinking fast. I'm drowning in the poison. Got no future, got no past. But my heart is not weary. It's light and it's free. I got nothing but affection for those who's singing with me. Everybody's moving if they ain't already there. Everybody's got to move somewhere. Stick with me, baby. Anyhow, things should start to get interesting right about now. My clothes are wet, tight on my skin, not as tight as the corner that I painted myself in. Is waiting to be kind. So give me your hand and say you'll be mine. The emptiness is endless, cold as the clay. You can always come back, but you can't come back all the way. There's only one thing I did wrong.
That is a rare version of Mississippi by Bob Dylan, an outtake from his Time Out of Mind sessions in 1997. Jim, what do you got next for us?
Well, Greg, I'm going to play something from the 2006 album Modern Times, but I want to make a point first. As critics, it has always bothered us when people live in the past and give their heroes a pass based on nostalgia. Mm-hmm. You and I are hardcore Dylan fans, but we will admit there have been some mistakes along the way. I think it only does him a disservice to not be honest in our criticism of him. When he's been great, he's been on fire. I think the Lenoir stuff was a little overproduced, and as he's been producing his own records as Jack Frost, pseudonymously, he's been indulging a penchant for Rudy Valley, Bing Crosby, 1930s kind of radio crooning pop. Mm. Whatever weird thing it conjures in his psyche from growing up or from what his grandparents played growing up, I don't know. I don't like hearing that stuff. But there are moments of sheer and utter brilliance on these albums. There are not many rock stars, we can say, have been into their 60s and 70s who you know, have maintained a level of excellence that is every bit as good as when they were at their peak. And I think really when all is said and done, you know, there was bad stuff on the first 10 Dylan albums too, mm-hmm. or stuff that wasn't as good as other stuff. And we can say the same of the new albums. And I will say, hands down, that the song I'm going to play, Ain't Talkin', which closes the Modern Times album in 2006, is the spookiest song this man ever has written. He's 65 at the time he's given us this. He's producing the album himself. It's a really pared down and simple musical setting he's creating. Lonesome fiddle, piano, little hand percussion, okay, and of course that voice. You talked about the deterioration of the voice. Well, for this song, it is the perfect voice, and he's mm-hmm. at the perfect age to be singing it. Is this a fallen angel, or is this the devil? Is this a preacher, or is this a sinner looking for salvation? It's almost 9 minutes long. This is Bob Dylan's Heroine, if you will, mm-hmm. by Lou Reed. It's epic. It's a Dante-esque vision of hell or temptation. He is struggling to do good, but he's also considering committing murder. Mm-hmm. You know, he's on this path. He doesn't know which way to go. It's an apocalyptic anthem. And I think, you know, I think this was the vibe that Lenoir was trying to get with a lot of production, and Dylan wound up getting it very simply with the words and a pared-down musical setting. I think it's an absolutely brilliant song. I defy you to find anything from the first 15 years of his career that is better than this, really. Ain't Talkin' by Bob Dylan on Sound Opinions.
As I walked out tonight in the mystic garden, the wounded flowers were dangling from the vine. I was passing by a young, cool crystal fountain. Someone hit me from behind. Ain't talking, just walking through this weary world of the world. Heart burning, still yearning. No one on earth would ever know. They say prayer has the power to heal, so pray for my mother. In the human heart, an evil spirit can dwell. I'm trying to love my neighbor and do good unto others. But oh mother, things ain't going well. Ain't talking, just walking. I'll burn that bridge before you can cross. Heart burning, still yearning. There'll be no mercy for you once you've lost.
That's Ain't Talkin' by Bob Dylan from his 2006 album Modern Times. And that wraps up our mini-series on Bob Dylan for now. At 75 years old, he's still got plenty of music in him, and he just released the 37th studio album of his career, Fallen Angels. Happy birthday, Bob. Please, come on by the show. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have a live performance and interview with the indie singer-songwriter Eleanor Friedberger.
Greg, Sound Opinions this week was produced by Evan Chung, Alex Claiborne, our intern Libby Gormley, and some much welcome help from Jason Mark.
Hello, who is that speaking, please?
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Hi, my name is Richard Kagan in Philadelphia, calling about the Dylan program. Terrific program. But I have to say that I think you're way off base minimizing how important the peace movement and civil rights movement were to Dylan. And certainly how important he was to those movements. I was a college sophomore in 1963, and for those of us who were activists, Pete Seeger, Bob Dylan, Tom Paxton, Phil Oakes, Joan Baez, they all spoke for us, but especially Bob Dylan. He followed Woody Guthrie's footsteps in supporting social justice.
He went down to Oxford town, guns and clubs followed him down, all because his face was brown. Better get away from Oxford town.
As for Al Kooper's comments that the Newport fans booed primarily because he performed a short set, I think Kooper misunderstood the absolute disappointment and betrayal we in the folk movement and the movements for social justice felt. That's what I needed to say.
Come, you masters of war. Here they build the big guns. Here they build the death planes. Here they build all the bombs.
Hi, my name is Janet. I'm calling from Kansas City, Missouri. I am so very pleased that you played Masters of War. It's just fantastic. It gives me chills every time. My future then husband, now 49 years, husband and wife, he introduced me, you know, when we were first dating, to Bob Dylan. And it helped him get through 4 years in the missile services as an electrician. He wanted to join in 1962 to fly planes, and they said, you're an electrician, we're going to put you in the new missiles maintenance. Well, that was dark days for him because he didn't like missiles, of course, nuclear missiles, but, you know, there you are. And we've kept Bob Dylan close to our hearts. Thank you again for doing these two programs on Bob Dylan.
Hey guys, Larry in Miami. Love the show. I wish I could say that I was surprised by your double buy it for the new Radiohead. I don't understand what ears I don't have that I can't appreciate the greatness. I really appreciate the fact that they do push boundaries and they don't do the same thing over and over again. But the critical acclaim is just absolutely mind-numbing. I think at this point, if they release 60 minutes of an EKG with a drum beat under it, music critics would fall all over themselves talking about how experimental and transportive it is. I don't get it. They used to write songs. They're barely songs now. Now it's just atmosphere. Keep up the good work. Keep reviewing. Even if I don't agree, I'll keep listening. Thanks.
Hey, y'all. Bryce calling from Los Angeles, where I am currently listening to The Tragically Hip and lamenting that I've never heard you utter those words on your show. And especially considering lead singer Gordon Downie's recent health diagnosis, it's about time they were. I consider them one of the most criminally underrated bands in rock history, at least in the U.S.
No dress rehearsal. This is
I would posit that not only do they qualify for the Grand Slam status, but their first 7 albums deserve that recognition, from the Tragically Hip EP all the way to Phantom Power. And as one of your openings says, if you don't agree, I will fight you. So I do hope Downie makes a full recovery and we have that band around for all the rest of my days. So thanks for the show, and see you at the Hip shows this summer, I hope.
No more messages.
To give us your opinions on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with more Sound Opinions, produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.